Hi, this is David McQueen, and welcome to the David McQueen Podcast. Shazia Jinai. When we recorded this, she was the CEO of Neuro Insight in the UK, but is now currently the Chief Growth Officer at Catalyx.
I'm excited to have a friend and a colleague on my podcast today. Please, can I hear from myself first a round of applause, and can I just say welcome to you, Shazia?
Thank you. I'm so excited.
Good. And I am as well. Long overdue. And thank you for coming on the Brave Leader podcast. My first question that I ask all my guests are, what did you have for breakfast?
I had for breakfast today, I had a cup of tea because I have to have a cup of tea first thing in the morning. Mm-hmm. And I had two slices of toast with peanut butter. And specifically, I have a dark rye and sunflower seed bread.
Okay.
And there's a reason, right? So rye bread or sourdough is less inflammatory. And because I have endometriosis, mm-hmm. I've adjusted my diet to sort of not have to give up bread because I love it so much, but now it's the devil. So I found a loophole and I found the types of bread that I can probably have that will make me slightly less inflamed. Yeah,
I love the fact that we have just gone in straight away.
Oh, by the way, I had that after I did some yoga. So there you go.
Bring it all around. It's as an aside, and I know this is question one. I think I told you I had my annual health check, a full comprehensive health check, and it was 98%. Right, I got 9 out of 10 on my card. Apart from the fact that I have had accumulated a little bit of weight around my midriff. Mm. And so part of it, again, has made me start to think about what are those things that I need to reduce or eliminate from the diet to make sure that I have that full health. And, you know, when I go back next year to have my thing, that it's not a question of, oh, my God, David, you need to lose X, Y, or Z. So interesting thing. You have been, and you did this straight away, and I'm going to admire you for it straight away. You have been very outspoken. Not only to me, because we've had great discussions. For the interest of clarity, I've had the pleasure of coaching Shazia. Let me just say this. She has been a client who has become a friend. Okay. But one of the things I have always admired you for has been around that clarity, that honesty, and that openness around speaking about endometriosis. And I'd love you to riff on that a bit as to, you know, what is it that brought you to that space to be able to talk about it as boldly as you do?
Yeah, so I mean, like, to be clear, I didn't at first for a very long time. So I was diagnosed when I was 25 and I had my first surgery when I was 26. And I remember at the time, you know, nobody really knew what it was. No one in my family knew. I didn't know. Most of my friends didn't know. And I actually didn't tell hardly anyone. So like my mates knew, but only my immediate family, but none of my relatives or none of my sort of religious or cultural community knew. I'm South Asian, I'm Muslim, and endo affects your fertility. And so it was a no-go zone making that publicly known, right? Because our lady parts are all about shame in our culture and we don't talk about our lady parts. And so I just didn't say anything. And I had my second surgery when I was 35, and just after I got approached, so I'd been volunteering for Endometriosis UK, so I did start doing some stuff, you know, more vocally, but again, not super publicly. So I volunteered for Endometriosis UK, as a support group worker. So I set up at my local hospital kind of the support groups, and I had a Facebook page set up, and I think I had about 90 women who I was supporting on the Facebook page, and I'd have several women come in for groups. I didn't talk about it on my own social platforms or anything until Endo UK asked me to participate in an exhibition that they were running. And it was a campaign on invisible illnesses being done in partnership with Standard Life, the insurance company. So they called me up and I knew what was happening. It was a bit close to when the campaign was running and they were looking for diversity. So they needed some more black and brown faces.
Yeah.
So they asked me to join in. And of course, I said yes. I then went through the hellish ordeal of trying to figure out how to have my face being in this exhibition with or without a headscarf on my head, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, cried a lot. I spoke to my mom, I spoke to my friends, I'm kind of trying to work it out. And that was the beginning, that was the moment when I sort of started going public about it. So signed up for this exhibition. Rankin was the photographer. So huge, huge deal and like a massive moment for me.
Yes.
I met him. We ended up staying in touch. We just really like connected. It was amazing. He took the photo and then it went up in this gallery in central London for a week and then in Scotland for a week. And it was all over the press. And I also was then interviewed by iNews about my endometriosis, and that was the first time it went public. And I still couldn't post on my own social media. I was still terrified of putting it out there because your own Facebook or Instagram is where, you know, the people in your life are kind of seeing your life, judging your life. And I knew lots of people from the mosque were on it. My best mate, Asma, who you have met and know, she said, "Can I post it?" And I remember just sort of like, you know, shutting my eyes and going, "Yeah, go on then," and then hiding under a pillow. And she did. And then I was like, "Do you know what? It's time." So I had this picture of myself from the exhibition and I did this post on social and everybody was loving it. You know, people really came in from all angles, kind of embracing it. There were some people who I was quite nervous about, the ones who sort of take pity on you because, oh, you know, thing. She's already not married, she's quite old, you know, in our culture I was sort of off the shelf and I deigned to make a career instead of babies, and so it was quite terrifying. And literally within the same months I got promoted to CEO, so there was a lot going on at the same time. And yeah, it was scary. I mean, you open yourself up to sort of a world of pain when you do that, because it's quite true. Like, people then start coming to you and telling you their stories. You get bombarded with information about it. You sort of live in the illness really openly. And sometimes you just want to forget it exists. So it was tough, but it was amazing. And I was told recently, actually, by my aunt who's visiting from New York, that my story has helped a lot of other people. And so that's what I would take from it as being, you know, the best outcome.
It was a powerful journey to observe from the side.
Yeah, I mean, you got the brunt of it.
But it was all right. You know, it was all right, you know, to know as a friend I could have been there, but also learning so much on that journey from the cultural aspect, from you know, having to face a lot of those fears and in a conversation was a massive learning curve for me. And I guess in many ways, it takes me back to my next question. Being in that position and being in that position of influence, so to speak.
Yeah.
Being in that position where, again, as you say, a young lady of South Asian Pakistani Muslim heritage, where some of this isn't talked about and it is suppressed. I'm kind of curious as to your leadership journey as a whole. How did you get into it? What is it that really sparked you? And we can make our way, we can put some threads together to wait, because I've got some theories about how you were bold enough to speak on this, but I'm really curious to go back and explore how you got into your actual journey yourself.
I mean, do you know what? I think if someone had asked me a little while ago, I wouldn't have known the answer to this. But something happened recently that kind of gave me the answer to this.
Okay.
So I don't think I've told you this, but my mum and dad were sort of decorating a little bit, a couple of bedrooms upstairs in the house, and they were having a clear out, and they found some stuff that belonged to me and gave it to me, and it included my record of achievement, right? With that weird burgundy folder that people of a certain age will have, and it is leathery, and it has the gold thing on it, and it has all your certificates and stuff. And when we were kids, so I was born in Kent, and when I was about 14, we moved to Hertfordshire, and so I changed schools, and I had a page in this record of achievement, and it says, it was like, I wrote a little statement at the end of the year, and I was 15 years old, right? I mean, I'm quite an articulate person, I will own that, and I'm really proud of that. I read a lot, and I, you know, I love language, but my handwriting was so neat. And I saw, you know, this faded fountain pen paragraph, and it said, you know, I feel I've adjusted really well to this new school. However, I think I'm still struggling with the fact that some of my teachers won't accept my faith and they've had some problems with it. And I read this and I was just like, wow, I was really outspoken even as a child to be brave enough to kind of call out your teachers on in writing. In this record of achievement, which is now still in existence, I can look at that now and I wonder if I went back to the school, they would be horrified, right? Because now everyone cares about diversity and inclusion.
Yeah.
When they didn't even think it was a problem that, you know, they said these things back then. So I'm looking back and I was reading it and I laughed and sort of said to my mum and to my sister, and I think everyone in my family sort of like, but you were always going to be in the leadership position.
Mm.
So I had no idea. I didn't really get it. And I know that when I had first spoken to you, you saw in me something that I just thought that he's just blowing smoke up my ass, right? This is not a real thing. But looking back, I think my leadership journey has been, and I've had sort of hypnotherapy, which has led to this. I think when we started coaching, it was about this. It was all about my voice. So there was a piece around me wanting to speak my truth and not being able to. And that was a big part of when I got to a point where I was comfortable enough and knew that I was worthy enough of being able to speak my truth. That was when my leadership was really coming into play. And there was a chunk where that did not happen, which was when I worked at GHD. I did 4 years there. It was a really turbulent and quite toxic environment to work in. And I shut my voice down quite a lot there. But that was definitely kind of my gateway. I don't know if I've answered your question.
You have. You have.
Going on some kind of cathartic, therapeutic.
This is the story. This is our conversations, right? We told we're going to keep it real, right? This is how it's going to be. But that makes a lot of sense. And again, one of the joys of working alongside amazing leaders like you is being able to see that potential, being able to see that capacity to be in a position of influence and to lead. Now I know that you also wrote like me in Parker fountain pen, probably with the ink bottle nearby you, right? Making sure you could do it. Or with the cartridges that were inside, right? One of the two, you had both. It was I see some alignment there, so it actually makes a lot of sense for you now.
There was a time when they didn't let you write with anything else. Bizarre.
It was. And you had to write in cursive.
And to be fair, I was left-handed, so there was always a risk of the smudge.
Yes.
And I'm like one of the only left-handed person who doesn't write with their hand twisted round, so yes, it's right, yeah, yeah. It's right-handed.
Yeah.
So they were some tough times. I mean, the other thing I think that was really apparent was, so again, culturally, like we're not really meant to, you know, we're meant to go to, like my dad wanted us to go to university, he wanted us to be educated, but you're not really meant to leave and never come back. Like both my sisters and my brother went to university, finished their degrees, moved back home. My sisters lived at home till they got married and then they were moved out. I left and I never went back.
Yeah.
And I insisted on going and carving out a path that hadn't necessarily been lived by the people around me before.
Yeah.
And I think in my head, when I looked at it, I just thought I was defiant and I just wanted to do what I wanted to do. And I perhaps was trying to escape certain things. Yeah. I never saw it as leadership until, with hindsight, I recognized that I was kind of taking ownership of my own path, yeah, and living my own life in a way that I chose rather than the way that was dictated to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was tough.
100%.
Hard.
It's all good. 100%.
Yeah.
Talk to me about some of the role models that you've had that have really inspired you around your leadership.
So there's probably a few. I actually think it's quite hard to find one person who encompasses everything about it.
Yeah.
Over my career, I've met a few. So there was when I was at GHD, it was owned by a private equity firm. I was there when it was sold to Trade as well. So the process of going through that means a culture shifts quite drastically. But when I had just joined, they had been acquired by Lion Capital. And the CEO at the time was a guy called Paul Stoneham. And he really liked me. A lot of people didn't get on with him, but he really liked me. And we got on fine. But he didn't last long after I was there. He was then taken, you know, he was removed and somebody else came in as an interim. And then a third one came in after that. In 4 years, I saw three execs come in.
Wow.
The one in the middle was interim. They hired him on an interim basis and he was the best of the lot.
Hmm.
His name was Sebastian Lazelle, and he, I believe, is currently the CEO of Denby, you know, the dishes.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Here's one of the things I got from him as a role model. He took the time to get to know people. He was a people guy.
Yeah.
And he didn't just do it for the sake of it. When he talked to you, he was talking to you. He engaged in the conversation. He was an empathetic leader. And you know how I feel about this. He's a man. I say was, he's not dead, he's still alive. He's a man. And had a lot of traits that showed me that he had a marriage of masculine and feminine energy in a way that I think is super conducive to leadership.
Yeah.
So he's definitely one. I would say another role model is, I'm an Ahmadi Muslim.
Mm.
And we have a Khalifa, a caliph. And it's currently the fifth since the advent of the Messiah that we believe happened. And I will openly say this as if I get in any trouble in case whoever hears this, but the current Khalifa I feel not very connected to, but the fourth Khalifa I had a huge connection with. And again, he had a warm and empathetic nature, and you could see kind of the caring and the joy in his face.
Yes.
And I think that's a common thread for me when it comes to leaders. When they're people,
yes,
and they care about the individual and not just the volume that you can create or the power that you can accumulate. He was super, and it also, you know, we had a very strong connection because he heard me sing when I was younger, and that built the relationship that I had with him. He asked me to sing a huge event, and you know, from there I kind of came in touch with my voice in a different way through some singing. So he had a very powerful impact on my life. So he's another one. I think there's a ton of women who I have in my network who I would say are role models, like female role models. My friend Kristen Luck, she's the founder of Women in Research. She's also, you know, just a power. Sits on a million boards and kind of has limitations in her life, and she's kind of come up, you know, from a place of not a lot of privilege, you know, so she's really worked hard and fought for things that she believes in. So that kind of the empathy, the warmth, the people, and also the want to drive positive change, and having, you know, the ability to remove limits. And I don't mean it in like a friggin' Elon Musk Jeff Bezos way, because they also probably are the we have no limits people, but there's an aggression in that. And to me, you know, people who will remove limits in order to try and change the world in a way that's different. And then there's one other person, right, who, I mean, my mum is in there as well, because Jesus, I mean, that woman, she is like this spiritual Yoda type lady. You know, she's a truly wisdomous and powerful matriarch. You know, she came to this country at 22 years old, left her family behind, had an arranged marriage to my dad, and has adapted and adjusted at every twist and turn that she's faced. You know, I have two brother-in-laws and they're white. Like, she is known as the one with the white son-in-laws. And people come to her for advice, right, when their daughters and sons are doing the thing that in the Western world you do, which is have a secret boyfriend or girlfriend that no one knows about. And mum's kind of the go-to sacred space. And then the other person is actually a friend of mine who I met at a yoga retreat. And the reason I would say she's a leadership role model is we met at a retreat and we did our first breathwork together in 2018. And she then trained in breathwork facilitation and she ran a yoga retreat with another friend in November last year. And she has fibromyalgia. So we both really connected on the whole chronic pain thing. And we sort of fell in love when we met. And she led us through that retreat in a way that kind of encompassed all these things that I've said.
Yes.
The caring, the empathy, the want to remove limitations and change and carve new paths. And she also has, and I guess all these people I've mentioned have, a really grounded strength, you know. And that is very different to most of the people I see in leadership who have a ignorant power trip mentality as opposed to a grounded strength. Yeah,
you know me. I could just sit down and listen to you for days. You can continue. I'm not even thinking about time, man. But
there is one other person.
Go ahead.
But you've been huge. I mean, it goes without saying that you've been an enormous influence on my journey, and you sort of demonstrate leadership in quite a different way to me. Like, you're the person. You're the take no bullshit guy. Love that, because you taught me about not the grounded strength piece, I think, is different, but you taught me about resilience, which I think is an edge, slightly edgier version of that. And you said words to me in our first coaching session, which I have continued to use every day until now and share with others, which is you gave me permission. And that, in my leadership journey, I have taken that and used it. I've stolen it and basically used it.
You haven't stolen it. You've adopted it. It's fine. It's absolutely fine, because I would have got it from somewhere else. It's amazing hearing you verbalize those role models, because, again, I remember in our sessions, for me, the breakthrough piece was you finding your voice. And so much around, you know, we started it off, the framing was around Urdu poetry, and then it just expanded to something else from there. And that for me has always been the thing, you know, whether you were talking on behalf of endometriosis, whether you were talking about your representation in your community, whatever it was always about that finding of the voice. And that's powerful. And for me, I think you've already answered my next question, what that good leadership looks like, because you've talked about the groundedness, the resilience, the marriage between the masculine and the feminine. If you want to expand on that any further, that's fine. But for me, it's so clear what that good leadership looks like for you. If you want to build on that, that's absolutely fine.
I mean, I think, I have covered it pretty much. I think a big part of it is nurture. And I don't necessarily believe that's a priority most of the time for most people. And it's nurturing in a million different ways. I think it's just the language that is used usually in leadership tends to be a lot more aggressive, and something like nurture feels too soft. But I believe it's what works, because that is how Mother Earth has basically existed all this time, is through nurture. Yes. And the way that we've messed it up is through the aggressive power.
Mm.
You can look at the environment and see that.
Yes.
So I would say that's one of the other things I would call out as a characteristic.
Definitely. Good, good. Let me switch it up a bit.
Go on then.
Tell me one of the toughest decisions you've had to make as a leader.
Christ, I mean, I became CEO in June 2019, and I had to rework how the business that I acquired works. So it's obviously very different when you are a founder of a company and you create it from scratch versus when you inherit something and you have to undo what wasn't working and shape it again. And, you know, I did a lot of changing to a lot of things that were challenging. And then 2020 came and we had two very strong months. January and February were the strongest months I think Neuro Insight had had. And then COVID hit and all the hardest decisions that had to be made needed to be made.
Yeah.
I think there's quite a lot that I would say. I think the hardest, so the hardest decision was sticking to my guns. That is absolutely the hardest thing I do every single day, because one of the big changes that I had to make was the business made no profit, right? And the clients took us for a bit of a ride sometimes, because previously there was a lot of discounting that went on and the price was low. And I think that, you know, we all know this, right? When you price yourself low, you equate to someone psychologically a value equation that would put you at a lower point than some of your competitors. And it's fine if you're after volume and you know, you're not necessarily in the game of showcasing like this unbelievable best-in-class value. But we were doing an amazing job and not charging what we should have for it. When I changed that, the hardest thing was the pushback and having to stick to my guns. Yeah. So my hardest decision was adjusting the pricing model for the business, knowing that I may lose some clients that were legacy clients and used to the heavy discounting, getting their way. But I stuck to my guns. I had some really tough conversations with some clients.
Yes, you did.
And then I had some really interesting adaptations for my team. And I had to, you know, kind of pull a little bit and push a little bit to get the potential really realized from the team that I knew could do the work that was worth the money that the clients were paying. And I still, right now, you know, coming out of COVID, I still have the odd legacy client that wants me to give them, you know, 20-30% off of where I'm pricing, which is absurd.
Yeah.
And I'm still sticking to my guns. They're the hard decisions. And you know, it generates profit, but then you're constantly shitting yourself about where the revenue is going to come from, right?
Yeah.
You have to change when you change something like that, the entire model changes. You know, your sales funnel changes because you're after people with different appetites for stuff, with different budgets, with different objectives. And so it isn't one lever. Mm. There's a domino effect on so much.
Yeah.
And it was the hardest decision. It's going to be, and it is, and it will be the most rewarding decision for financials, but it's also been the most rewarding decision for my people because people believe that their work is worth more.
Yes, yeah.
That's powerful.
Yeah, no, definitely. I was having a conversation yesterday with somebody who was saying that, used the metaphor of boxing, which isn't necessarily my favorite, but I thought I'd run with it. And he was saying that before you get into a ring to go 12 rounds, you're going to get lots of punches and bruises long before that. And that's what toughens you up to be in the ring. And again, whilst I'm not the biggest fan of people punching the shit out of each other over 12 rounds, I really got that metaphor. And I really understand that around being brave, being courageous, being bold, is that you're going to get a couple of punches, you're going to get a couple of bruises.
Yeah.
And in some, sometimes it's a bit like, if you think about the, we were talking earlier about the a podcast where somebody runs thousands and thousands of miles. You know, when people run long distance, they get bruises. They, you know, the foot aches and what have you, but the, there's something in the victory and the mindset. So that's, yeah, that's quite powerful.
It is. I think that the only thing that I definitely would say is you have to be prepared for the fact that it won't always go as you'd intended, but also you have to be prepared to cough up the goods if you're going to make that level of change. So there was a piece that I had to do around, I can't just go, here's my pricing increase and you're going to get the same as what you had before. It was, how do we make this so that it really showcases the value? And that doesn't mean doing a bunch of extra work, otherwise you're still not going to get the profit margins that you were looking for. It was about being smarter. And, you know, one of the most beautiful and dangerous things about my company and my role in that is I know too much.
Yeah.
You know, I've spent my career working in research. So it's been understanding what humans think and feel about stuff. Then I start measuring the brain and I get into a whole other space. I have the books behind me. I have a whole other stack of bookshelf downstairs in my lounge, and I read constantly and almost bombard myself with way too much information on how the human psyche is going to take what I'm giving it.
Yes.
And so, you know, it was about kind of figuring out which bits of that knowledge that I have, yeah, I really needed to harness to be able to maximize what we had. Yes. Some of the aesthetic,
yeah,
you know, there was something about the way that our work looked that wasn't quite right.
Mm.
And so improving that. And, you know, I gave autonomy to my team to kind of come up with ideas, and mm-hmm, they were like, yes, you know, we get to be creative. And suddenly all of this stuff is flowing out that, yeah, I could never have done in isolation, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I love that agency on autonomy that you talk about, that allows the team to really thrive.
Yeah.
So in transparency, I believe a lot of that came because you desired that when you were being led.
Yeah, it did.
So I guess my question following that is, as a leader, how are you creating a succession plan or the capacity for a leadership bench that can either take over if you decide to go, or can be equipped enough that if they decided to leave, they can take your learnings and go somewhere else?
This is a really hard question because I've been thinking about it a lot. Mm-hmm. And I'm working it out.
Yeah.
Succession planning is really tough, right? Because you have to learn to let go of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And also, so there's the bit of your ego that's like, I want the legacy to be so great that no one's going to say a bad word about me when I go. And that is completely ridiculous because, yeah, let's be honest, when the person leaves, everything is their fault.
Right.
And you have to kind of be okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what I'm working on at the moment as part of this is almost kind of, we've come out of COVID, which makes everything a bit difficult because we're still sort of settling, right?
Yeah.
And it's about almost identifying what the culture and the values are really going to look like and setting that in place, and then bringing someone in that isn't necessarily a fit to that, but is someone that can build and enhance on that.
Yes.
Because my current team as it stands, no one within it that is going to be the person who takes over. And yeah, they all know that. And it's mostly because none of them have a desire to.
Yeah.
And they are fit to do that. And they know it. If one of them turned around to me and said, I want to be the person, I'd be like, right, okay, let's figure out what that could look like. Mm. And we'll have a very honest conversation about whether or not that's going to be a thing.
Yeah.
But I would say bringing somebody in that can enhance and build, because it's not going to be me anymore. And it can't always be Shazia's company, because it was never Shazia's company to begin with, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's tough. I think the succession planning is something I don't have an answer right now. This is going to be a new thing for me. So yeah, you will have a lot of phone calls.
Yes. But it, I'm not sure it's going to be like, I love the honesty that you have, that there, it's very possible that there isn't the capacity or the desire in the current workforce to be in that space. And there are some people who want to lead by force, and it's a coercion to go, right, in my mind, you're going to be my successor. You're going to be next. So you're going to do that. And that person might be thinking, well, I actually just want to go home at 5:30.
Yeah.
And chill.
And also, you know, I think about my future. And if somebody said to me, like, now, I want you to do X, I'd be like, that's probably another 5 years or 10 years of my life that's gone.
Mm.
And, you know, we forget, I'm 39 years old. Mm. So most of the people who are working for me are in their late 20s and early 30s, right? Because the team is quite young. And the way that they look at the work world is very different to how I did or anyone older than me did, in that they look at their jobs as being a couple of years here and there. They might have multiple careers in that life. So the research director of my team, she's an absolute rock star, Holly, and she is also doing a part-time degree in osteopathy.
Mm.
So a 5-year part-time degree. She's in her fourth year at the moment, right? And we have loads of conversations where I'm like, you know, she's gone down to part-time, so she's doing one day a week in the clinic and 4 days a week with us at Neuro Insight. And by the way, she's never worked harder because I gave her the ability to have that flex in her working life.
Yeah.
She's so committed.
Mm.
You know, we've talked about when the degree finishes, you know, she might not come back full-time. She might still do, a day in her own clinic. Like, and all of them have, what I choose, you know, their path might be completely different. I'm training to be a breathwork facilitator, and at the end of the year, I'm starting a part-time 2-year yoga teacher training course.
Yes.
I may, in the future, wherever I go next, be asked to do something random, and I'll be like, well, maybe I want to work part-time and do some yoga teacher stuff and some breathwork stuff. I don't know. So when people assume, I sort of feel like it's, you're shooting yourself in the foot, right? Because the person hasn't actively communicated their commitment to it. You've kind of made them believe that that's the path they're meant to take.
Yes, yeah. No, that's powerful. That's actually quite powerful. Because again, as you said, well, by the way, I'm going to be there for the breathwork classes. Let's just park that now and let's just get out of the way. Come January 2023, I'm signing up for breathwork. Let's just get that out of the way now. Okay, so I'm talking to the people who you lead.
Yeah.
And I'm asking them two questions. I'm asking them, firstly, what does Shah, because that's who I call you, what does Shah do well? And what can Shah improve on?
Okay. So they would say what I do well is care about them. I care about my people. I used to be really bad at owning the things that I'm good at, but they've taught me that there's a lot of love there, and they would say that I am motivating, and that the things I'm good at are speaking truth to power.
Yep.
So they've watched me take on some extracurriculars. I sit on the Market Research Society's Diversity and Inclusion Council. I became board chair for Colour of Research. I'm part of the Women in Research exec, and they know that I'm passionate about stuff. So they'd say that that's what I'm good at, caring about people, having a sense of purpose and cause. The thing I think that they would comment on that I am less good at is managing my diary. So I exist in my own version of organized chaos. And I think that this is a common trait in a lot of leaders. I think we assume that, because, you know, when you're younger and it's like, I'm organized, I'm good at timekeeping, they're kind of like the traits that you build yourself to have, because they are things that every job description has on it when you apply for it.
Yes.
You must be good at this. Communication, timekeeping, organized, works in a team and well, you know, well with others and on their own. But then you get older and you spin a shitload of plates.
Yeah.
And you're actually really good at knowing your system, but no one else will understand your system for love nor money, right? Yeah. And I think that that's what they would probably comment on.
Yeah.
that I need to just get a bit better. I've told them, I said, you have my phone number. We have Teams, WhatsApp, email, and a phone. So if I do not get back to you, you have every right and all the permission to hound me until I do, because I can be a little bit, you know, all over the shop.
And that is why I have an executive assistant, because I know I am absolutely crap. My whole diary is just managed that way, and my stress levels and cortisol levels have just dropped right down because I don't have to do that anymore.
Well, this is on my list, right? Because I actually think that someone could help. You know, there are people out there who have skills beyond mine.
100%.
And I think I'm working on my control issues to allow someone to come in and take over. I'm very cognizant of that. Because I know that I'm like, how are they going to understand what works for me? And then I'm like, no, Shazzy, you need to.
They do.
Of course they do.
and like me, you have multiple interests and multiple diaries to manage. Having somebody who will get that is, trust me, that is the gold. That is pure gold. And it's a journey. It's a journey, right? Because it's not going to go straight away. But it's definitely a journey. That's insightful. Really good. Really good. Let's finish up on one last question then. Is your leadership shaped by the company that you work for, or is it something bigger?
Both. I'm going to say things that are so controversial for my company. So my leadership has been shaped by the company I work for, in that I've learned a lot of what not to do.
Okay.
So I work for the parent company, Neuro Insight, has three commercial businesses within it. Mm-hmm. They are run by three very different characters. I am the only female in the mix, and I witness a lot of, you know, sort of cultural things I disagree with. So there's a lot of stuff that I push against, and some stuff I take and go, oh, there's no way I'd implement that here.
Yeah.
So some of the what not to do. And a lot of the what to do comes from outside. I have a huge network of people that do things in different ways on purpose. So I diversified my network, not just in terms of the way people look, but in the way that they think and the kinds of work that they do, because I don't think that there's one right answer to leadership. I just don't. It's depending on the context in which you're operating, it can work in a million different ways. And so a lot of my influence comes from outside, but it comes from outside of my industry as well. So the net is cast pretty wide. And I read a lot, and I listen to too many podcasts, and my brain is full. But every time I get a nugget of something, it contributes to my process.
No, you can
never stop changing, I think.
No, of course not. If you did, I'll have you for it, I'll tell you. But the curiosity is important. It's we are and even you say that you listen to a lot of podcasts and read a lot of stuff. If you're anything like me, you get to a point where you've consumed some stuff and then you realize I actually don't know that much because there's still so much out there. But being okay with what you have, it's vast. It's absolutely vast. Yeah.
There's an unlimited amount of information. And the other thing is that the areas I'm most interested in around the body-mind connection, you know, the subconscious and all that good stuff, that field of research is forever changing. There's so many new discoveries happening all the time. And a lot of the work that we understand gets debunked all the time as well. So it's not even like you're just adding, you're literally switching stuff out constantly. So I have quite for me, it's important to have a healthy debate with what I'm hearing and seeing as well. So I can form my own viewpoint of what works for me.
Yeah, 100%. I appreciate you. Thank you.
I appreciate you. I want us to carry on talking for about 5 more hours. There's so much to cover, but we can't do.
Do you know what? I do believe I'm going to get you back. And what I will do is No, but I wanted people to, you made a point when I was asking about what shaped the company, and you said it's quite controversial, the point of view. I don't see it as controversial. I see it as an example of your brave leadership.
I
see it as that bit where, again, I always define you've heard it from me time and time again. I've always defined brave leadership as that ability to work with the talent and stakeholders by reducing the marginalization of those individuals around you and getting people to understand that. And again, you know, as the only woman in your company who's had to shift some stuff around and made some changes, which we won't talk about here, but doing that takes courage. That takes, even if you've got a support network around you, it takes courage to do that. And so I salute that. And I believe that when we come back, we're going to go into some of that thinking stuff. Let's go into, because you and I can nerd out on that for hours, but let's go into some of that thinking stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it goes without saying that process is not about tears, right?
100%.
So I have had like colossal meltdowns with the people in my life who are the people, you know, my people. Mm. You are one of those people, right? And so, you know, brave leadership comes with the vulnerability piece massively.
We'll definitely do this again. We'll think of something else, but we'll definitely do it. And I really appreciate you. Thank you so much, Shel.
Thank you. It's been awesome.
Dave McQueen Podcast is a Q Talent Management production. Theme music is Biscuit by Lacrimbo.